Hello, lacrosse friends. I'm Stephen Stamp, your host here at Box LaBeate and an editor at ilindoor.com. A bout of strep throat has moved me to the physically unable to perform list this week, but I am not leaving you in the lurch. We will go with a best of Box LaBeate, and it truly is one of the best episodes I think we've ever had. It is the loose ball face-off debate between two legends, Jeff Snyder and Jim Veltman. The question? Should a player who wins a face-off to himself be credited with both a face-off win and a loose ball? And who better to answer that question, or to at least debate it, than the legends Jeff Snyder and Jim Veltman? This is a throwback to April of 2016 on the Best of Box LaBeate on NLL Radio. Okay, really enjoyed having a roundtable discussion last week. I thought we'd try it again here on Box LaBeate. And this story arose because I made a comment on a post I saw on Twitter about some loose balls and some of the top loose ball people, and said something about, you know, that Jim Veltman and Brody Merrill's loose balls really counted more because the others were, I think it was actually Jeff Snyder, who got a lot of his loose balls on faceoffs. And that brought up some responses, some people liking it. And Travis Cornwall, who didn't like it at all, responded and said, why shouldn't the faceoff guy get a loose ball counted? It's been a discussion point for a lot of people over the years. Should a faceoff man who wins a faceoff to himself get credit for a loose ball? And on the call this week to discuss it, we have two guys who should know more than anyone what they're talking about. The two of the three leading loose ball guys of all time in the National Lacrosse League, Jim Veltman, number one with 2,417, and Jeff Snyder with 1,857, are first and third. John Tavares sandwiched in between them. And just to set the context a little bit, of the top 10 loose ball players of all time, Jeff Snyder is the only guy who was a principal face-off taker. Steve Toll is sixth in loose balls. He won 347 face-offs in his career. Phil Sanderson is ninth. He won 155. So Snyder, the only one who's really getting a lot of loose balls off of face-offs, who's in the top group. Welcome, Jeff Snyder.
Thanks for having me.
All right, and welcome Jim Veltman to the show.
Hey, Steve. Nice to be on the show.
It's great to have you both here. And just a little background on these guys. Not that you need a whole lot. Jim Veltman, of course, a Hall of Fame player, led the league in loose balls 14 times in a 15-year stretch. The only year he didn't, John Tavares led it, and Jim Veltman was not playing. Jeff Snyder is the unquestioned face-off king of the National Lacrosse League. Six times he led the leagues in face-off wins. He leads all time with 2,468 face-off wins. The guy doesn't show who has the top winning percentage, but I am about 99% sure that Jeff Snyder would have the highest percentage of anyone who took face-offs regularly, a real master. So the first point, we'll just let you each state your case briefly on why a face-off guy should or should not get a loose ball when he wins a face-off to himself. Starting with Jeff, you go ahead and make your argument.
Of course I get, well, you know what, it's appropriate I go first. Certainly not taking anything, you know, you're on a call here with the greatest of all time. So, you know, pretty much whatever Jim says is going to go here. But, you know, if you've ever taken a face-off, you're the way that I look at it is I'm on the ground, you know, wrestling a shaved gorilla for a ball. And you got two guys going head-to-head and trying to, you know, capture that ground ball. You know, any face-off guy, if he could, you know, the position that I started taking was, you know, you win a face-off out and you try and make it a 50-50 ground ball. And I think that was a lot of the times, you know, what I sort of faced. If you can pull a ball out and keep it to yourself, you know, it's a stat that I took a lot of pride in. I took more pride in ground ball stats than I would my face-off percentage. The two were usually just correlated. But if you can take a ball off the ground and get it into your stick before having to get it to anybody else, you know, you're doing your job. And the ball starts on the ground, you're competing with another guy who's got the exact same opportunity as you to collect that ball and get it for your team and put yourself in a position to score a goal.
Jim Veltman, your response.
Well, I mean, my response obviously is, going to be very respectful of Jeff Snyder. I mean, I don't think there is a question that there is any better face-off man in the game. So, and I haven't seen one. If there is one out there, maybe they should show themselves and help us out with New England. But I think Jeff is by far the best loose ball, or sorry, the best face-off man around. As far as loose balls off the face-off, I'm not exactly sure when that started. I don't know if it began early, or what year it began, or who decided that. I mean, tongue in cheek, this is going to sound like sour grapes on my part, but for me, the face-off seems like a closed skill. And what I mean by that is it's a skill that there's not a lot of variables as far as the ball, in movement. So you're dealing with a stationary ball, and to me, that's not a loose ball. That's just my opinion. Whereas with a loose ball stat on the floor, you have to deal with a lot of other things as far as, where it's bouncing off the boards, where it's bouncing to, what kind of players are involved. So to me, they're two different stats, but that's just my opinion, and I'll leave it at that for now and see what kind of rebuttal I get.
One thing I would add is on faceoffs. I mean, I came out obviously saying that I didn't think guys who want to face off to themselves should get a loose ball. And part of my feeling is because it's a dead ball, it's not. And then it's picked up. If it's picked up by one of the guys on the faceoff, it's never really loose. It just doesn't seem to me like it's actually loose. And most loose balls, as we consider them or define them, are available to theoretically all 10 of the runners on the floor, whereas the on the face-off, it's just the two guys battling. And I certainly never intended. I know Travis Cornwall got quite upset with me. He sounded not too happy with me on Twitter, and I never intended to take away from anything that Jeff Snyder did. I spent a summer or two watching Jeff. I watching you take face-offs in Peterborough, and was just amazed at the skill that you had for it. And I talked to people who had to face off against Jeff Snyder, who I remember Scott Self saying they sent him out for a game to take face offs. And after a while, he said, "I knew I couldn't beat him. So as soon as they blew the whistle, I just pick up my stick and start whacking at him, trying to get loose." I mean, it's an amazing talent that you've had, but it just, because of those parameters, as I said, Jeff, doesn't seem to me like it's a loose ball.
Yeah, and I can understand that. I think, the probably where the idea of it not being considered a loose ball would be the idea that guys don't necessarily know, haven't played the position. I think, aside from goaltending, it's probably one of the most misunderstood positions, top to bottom in sports. I didn't start facing off until I went to college. So I was on the loose ball team in Burnaby. Took a lot of pride in collecting loose balls, taking a lot of pride of, as a role player coming out of the corner with the ball. And so I've always been, prior to being a face-off guy, I was always, you obviously know about Jim Beltman, growing up, and you want to, I played with his nephew Daryl and Peter, and took a lot of pride in collecting that ball just based on the type of grit and the type of, tenacity that you have to be able to be that kind of guy. I think it's no question with Brody or, a guy like Steve Toll, even JT, guys that are leading in those categories are all very hungry, very competitive guys, and it's a stat that's correlated to being tough. I think what people don't necessarily understand is it's not like I'm stepping in, down and picking up a ball that's just on the ground that's uncontested. Like, you're wrestling another grown man to gain, to gain an advantage on that ball, whether you get it out immediately or you get it out in a pile of guys, or whether those 10 guys are kind of around you, you're still having to direct the ball to an area and still compete for a ball that's, whether it's in the air, on the ground, wherever that may be. There's been lots of times where I've had to go track down a loose ball going to the boards or whatnot. Also, you got to take it from the back of my stick and get it into the front of my stick. So it's not like it's not just it's a free loose ball that you can kind of just pick up on your own. So, I think it just comes, it stems, the idea that it is a loose ball stems from the fact that it is contested. You do have to have, there's a massive amount that goes into getting that ball off the ground in the air and into your stick. And it's a relatively misunderstood position. So I think that's kind of where, the argument would stem from, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I actually
And I think it's unbelievable, like how, you were able to do that. I mean, I remember, game plans against you, and we'd just basically put four guys back on the line just because we knew that you were going to win the ball clean and come down and have a transition opportunity. And I mean, even with you winning the ball, at least we were 5-on-4 as opposed to 4-on-3 or 3-on-2 with extra space for guys to do what they do in odd man situations. So, I mean, it really is truly unbelievable how you were able to pick up that ball. I guess where my argument comes in is, as a guy on the line, I couldn't get there in time. I mean, Les
Very good
Bartlett used
point.
to say, "Well, just pick up, hit Jeff when he gets the ball." And I used to come to the bench and say, "You know how hard that is? Like, I got to take 5 or 6 steps before I even get to him, and he's already, going down the other end. You might as well put me on the D line. At least I know he's coming towards me." And that, honestly, like, it is with utmost respect that I would say something like that. There's not too many guys that could do what you do. So I don't know if this is, more a debate about how good you were at doing that, so people are upset about that, or is it that, is it just a skill that a lot of people weren't are not able to do as good as you, and maybe it's sour grapes? I'm not sure.
Well, and you gotta in the same breath there, Jim, too, you gotta being in, and that's a very good point. I think that the magnitude of what Brody, yourself, Steve Toll, and those guys that compete in those positions, like you look at your numbers and like I wish I had, God, I wish I had 10 more years. Like to be able to, first of all, play 15 years in the National Lacrosse League is something, superhuman. And to play a role where you are putting yourself in competitive situations and taking the beating that you are to collect a ball and to to put up a stat like that, I don't think people necessarily understand how incredible it is to be able to just endure what you endured. That you make a very good point there. Was it a developed skill set that I was very fortunate to have? For sure. You do make a good point, is that a majority of the draws were a 1-on-1 contested loose ball. It wasn't a 5-on-1, where you're going in to compete for a ball against a number of different guys. I can certainly understand, that point as well. So is it unfair? It probably could be deemed as unfair. There isn't the same sort of stipulations or the same sort of some the contest varies in terms of how hard it is. Some guys have a face-off guy, some guys don't. But it is still, I think the big thing that I think people don't understand is that going in and taking a face-off, like if that's all you did, you would be exhausted at the end of a game. So having to play a full shift or running transition or doing what you're doing, there's a lot that goes into it too. So that's where my kind of position came on. And of course, me being me, I'm going to argue for the latter. But what you're doing, what you do too, is it's an incredible stat. And even Brody, like you look at Brody Merrill picking up loose balls. He is the key guy to be going in and collecting those on any given night, and he does a fantastic job not being a face-off guy. So there is a whole lot to be said about that as well.
I'll jump in and say, I almost feel like one of the issues, because I think this probably came up more through Jeff, through your career, because you won so many face-offs and got so many loose balls from them, because you weren't winning face-offs just by pulling it out and your guys were getting it. You're winning so many to yourself and almost making it look easy. Not even almost. I mean, there were times where it just looked really easy. And I remember watching face-offs and thinking, what is he doing? How is he so good at this? And other people, I talked to guys and they're like, I don't know. He's really quick. He anticipates well. He's just really strong. But it was, I think, in part, the whole debate might have arisen because you would win so many face-offs to yourself that people were like, it looked like you were just picking the ball up. It didn't look like it was difficult for you.
It just became, it became a skill set that we just don't develop in Canada enough. I think, we really need to look at the face-off rules. It's so unique how we do it in Canada with the circle and the lines, and that's archaic. It's been around since, geez, since we started facing off. in box lacrosse. So it's a hard position to develop in if you're not going to the United States and facing off in an American setting. And that being said, it's hard for Americans to break into it because, you know, just the lack of understanding of field lacrosse and the ability to play in that environment, kind of prevents that from happening. But, in terms of the ease of picking it up, it's, you know, making something look easy is a huge compliment, but you got to give a lot of the guys credit. The position has come a long way. Since I started in the league, there's a lot of really good guys now, and there's guys that are taking it really serious. And it doesn't necessarily affect the score of the game, but it does affect the momentum changes in the game for sure. If you can compound goals, and I haven't seen a rule that's changed more in a decade than the faceoff rule. Which is a huge compliment to the position. And it's not like they're changing. You know, Paddy Coyle changed cross-checking, and it's really interesting to see how much the position is being tinkered with to potentially give a unilateral sort of opportunity to collect the loose ball.
Well, yeah, and I don't know if a lot of people know, Jeff and Steve, you can contest to this, like the rule change for this year, right? Where if you plunge the ball down, you only allowed one step and you have to put that ball, in your stick proper way, in the proper side. So like you were, mentioning earlier how, and it's a difficult skill, but you basically have to run around with the ball on your stick backwards until you have enough time and space to flip it to your proper side to be able to pass. And I think even some face-off guys, you would just pass the ball with the ball on their stick backwards just to make that process easier. Mm-hmm. But, and I would argue too that, like someone like yourself changed the tide in even our field experience and being competitive with the U.S. I mean, in 2006, if you weren't as dominant as you were at the face-off circle, I'm not sure we win that game. And that's, I guess, like you said, I think we're not good enough at it, maybe at the Canadian level, and Americans are very good at it. Maybe we just don't emphasize it enough. I'm not sure. And I think what you're saying is true. I think people have a tremendous amount of respect for people who can take the face off. And getting back to, I guess, the debate that we're in is I think it should still be a stat on its own, because then you're giving it that more importance, whereas, and then leave the loose ball stat on its own and give that its importance as opposed to trying to combine.
Yeah, that's a very, very fair point, is that you do not want, having a good faceoff guy and being able to manipulate that ball and keeping it to himself, not giving you're just exposed as a faceoff guy, you're exposed to more loose ball opportunities. Being a good face-off guy means that you have a greater opportunity to pick that ball up, than other guys on the floor. There's only two guys on the floor that are presented with that opportunity. And that's actually a very fair point, is that, five offensive guys are presented with the opportunity to get an assist or a goal on a play. Five defensive guys have opportunities to create turnovers, where it does isolate that potential ground ball to two different guys on the floor. And that's a really good point. It makes actually a lot of sense. I don't know. You look at the stat keeping in the NHL or the NBA or the NFL, and you walk through the dome. There's archive after archive after archive of handwritten stats, and it probably becomes really cumbersome not to award. It probably makes a lot of sense maybe just to give it to guys just strictly in a 5-on-5 setting.
So it makes it challenging. I agree. I like that thought. I mean, that's one thing I know, Jim, you'd mentioned to me before, is that one of the issues you have with it is that it counts two statistics for one play. You scoop the ball up, you get a face-off win and a loose ball. And the tricky thing then is there just no loose ball if the face-off man wins it to himself? Then there's just no loose ball awarded on the play.
Yeah, I mean, now we're talking semantics, right? Like, that's... Yeah, maybe you call it something else or have a stat for that, particular play on the floor. I'm not sure. I mean, I like to know what the genesis of the loose ball stat on the face-off was. Like, I'm not sure if it was there right from the beginning or I don't know. I don't know where it came into the game exactly.
I'll
Well,
actually look into
you got to
that.
think, like, if I want to face, if whoever wins a face off out into a corner or into an area, and you go and compete for that loose ball, I just think that, you know, likely the it was always around. I just don't think that, you know, when it was first started, no one was being able to pull a ball off the ground into their stick. I think Wayne Goss was really good at it with New West. He'd flip it onto the back of his stick and pull it out on the cat gut, right? Like, there was never, I don't think when the stat was, when it was presented, it was ever thought that you would have that much control over a ball if you were a talented faceoff guy. You know, the plastic, you know, being able to bend your plastic and manipulate your stick to gain an advantage to pick up the ball, you know, I doubt was anticipated when that stat was created. So, you know, the question is what happens when, you know, you win a ball out between your legs directly into a defender's stick? Is that still, you know what I mean? Like, it becomes kind of a gray area, which, you know, I think there, you know, there's already a massive amount of gray area with the rules in lacrosse.
Now, is that considered a face-off win if you were to push the ball into one of your teammates' stick? Do you get that face-off win personally, or is that, I guess, in that case, there are
any time that a face-off, at least after once a loose ball is collected by any team, that is a face-off win that's awarded. So if I picked up, I won a face-off, picked up a loose ball, then I was stripped or I turned the ball over. Like, there could be three on a play. I could win a face-off. Like, this is what likely happens, Jim, is I win a face-off, I pick up a loose ball, and I throw a backhand into the stand. So I'm charged with a loose ball, a face-off win, and a turnover. So,
triple play.
Or you do what I've been accused of in the past, where you have a loose ball, you drop it, you pick it back up, and now you got two loose ball stats.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why. That's the only thing that helps me sleep at night, Jim, knowing that I never caught your loose ball record was the fact that you must have done that 100 times.
Now, it's interesting. That's another interesting point, Jeff, you bring up. First of all, thought that people probably didn't, when they were making the rules, people probably didn't expect you'd be able to do it. I hadn't ever thought of that. And that's a pretty interesting point. The other one is when you pull that ball back, you could pull it, like you mentioned, there could be three guys from one team on the line and one from the other team. You pull it back to where your three players are. And if that one guy from the other team somehow beats your three guys and gets the ball, the other faceoff guy gets a faceoff win, even though he was beaten cleanly, getting the ball out. And it was just his teammate that went and did it. And that is a bit of an odd one. Now, in hockey, it's so simple because you can't be across the line. So you have to be behind level two or behind your center. So if you pull the puck back between your legs, you've won the faceoff. There's no question. And it really does. It's another gray area, like you said, when the ball just comes out and whoever comes up with it, that the faceoff man for that team gets the faceoff win.
Exactly. And they should get that win. To be honest with you, it shouldn't be whether I choose to put a ball in a different location after controlling a draw, that's up to me as a faceoff guy. So, you know, if I choose not to put the ball there, then we don't run into a problem of you not being awarded a faceoff win. So, and a good on whoever the player is that's competing in that environment.
Yeah.
You know, I could tell you wherever Jim was on the floor, that's not where the ball was going. So like if you try and keep it away from certain guys for different reasons. And, you know, the best thing I love about the stat is, you know, it's a stat that is, it's purely a selfish thing, but it's a thing that really helps your team out if you can do it well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's one thing that I really enjoyed about it. It was always a really interesting thing and something that I think Jim probably took a lot of pride in, you know, being able to collect that loose ball and make a smart play. You know, I doubt that he made very uneducated plays coming out of there with it. And it just helps your team that much more. That's 2,000 scoring opportunities that you create that he created for his team over the life of his career. And, you know, when you got guys like Colin Doyle and Shooter and guys like that, the ball's going to find the back of the net more than not. And, you know, it's a massive contribution to your team.
Jim, do you want to point out that it was 2,417, not just 2,000?
Yeah. I was rounding down. Give me that, Stamper. Give me that.
Okay. All right. You were very close to it. The last thing I'd like to get both your opinions on is with the new rule, where, as Jim was pointing out, you can only take one step with the ball in the back of your stick, because we've all seen Jeff and others pick the ball up in the back of the stick, start running, get some open space, flip it up, turn the stick over and catch it, and then you can control the ball. You can't do that anymore. You've got one step, and that ball's got to go somewhere. It does have a big impact on how many loose balls a face-off guy can get, and changes the dynamic, even though, I mean, there's still some time because the players do have to run in from the line, but, boy, they're coming quick. What do you guys think about the new rule?
Well, I wish I was on the competition committee, because I would have loved to hear the rationale behind it, to be honest. I'm not exactly sure if I totally agree with it or not. We don't have a great face-off guy, so obviously we like the rule just because it just creates a little bit more knowing on our part that the ball's going to be popped up after one step, whereas before we didn't know when that face-off man was going to actually pop the ball off his back of his stick to the front of his stick or throw it to somebody or whatever. So it helps a team like ours right now. But, yeah, I would have loved to have been in that competition, you know, committee meeting and hear the rationale of why they did that.
Yeah, you know, I think it's one of those things where they're trying to create more 50-50 opportunities. You know, I would imagine that it was voted, you know, it was voted, you know, by the teams that probably didn't have that stat. You know, the big thing that I can tell you is it's a, I love it. I wish that I was in there right now, because I really enjoy the fact that you got to get the ball up and out. Getting into these wrestling matches and these grinds is what they want to get everybody away from. And, you know, being able to take the ball from the ground and have it up in the air, guys either have to compete for faceoffs or they let you win the draw and pull it to space. Where the whole running on the back of the stick kind of, I think, stemmed from is that faceoff guys weren't competing for the ball anymore. They were just trying to tie you up and kind of disrupt the play so that you weren't able to pull the ball from the back of your stick to the front of your stick in a clean motion. So what do? You just don't do that, and then you run out of trouble, and then you pop it to yourself when you're in the clear. It's a double-edged sword. I think it's really beneficial because there's not a lot of guys who can take the ball from the ground to their stick in one kind of fluid motion, where, you know, now they're kind of mandating that to be a successful face-off guy, which, you know, makes it beneficial for the guys who are really good at it. They're going to keep tinkering with it until they find the common ground. I think if you ask Dave Huntley, and, you know, he'll tell you to get rid of the face-offs. He always gives me a hard time about that. And, you know, now that I'm not playing anymore, you know, that sounds great.
So what's Dave's idea? You just throw the ball up in the air and let everyone race for it?
Well, in basketball, didn't they used to do a jump ball after every basket? I think that's kind of the idea.
They did.
They would.
So I guess after a goal, you can just give it to the team that it was scored on.
Exactly. Like, you know,
that sounds more like girls' field lacrosse, where you could just put the ball between sticks and you got to flip it up in the air somewhere.
Yeah.
I tell you what, like, being, you know, obviously I'm biased, but I think the face-off is a real, it's an entertaining part of the game. You know, when you have broken plays and goals, it's out of the face-off, it's exciting. And, you know, to be honest, the reason why lacrosse is such a great sport is you can be down by 5 goals and creep back into a game pretty quickly if you start compounding some goals on one another. So I don't know if it's necessarily something that you want to remove or not, but you know, and I'm speaking absolutely biasedly, but it's an entertaining part of the game, and obviously it's a position for your fiercest competitors. That face-off loose ball team, you know, is all the guys that, you know, you would probably want in a foxhole with you somewhere on a battlefield, because they're the guys that are the most fierce and the most competitive. It's a, you know, a, a, and it's kind of an unsung kind of hero, that face off loose ball team. There's a lot of guys out there that compete very hard and guys that you kind of want around, and they're usually your character guys.
Well, and to be able to find a face-off guy who can play good defense and good transition, or even offense. I mean, I'm not going to take away from offensive players that they can't take face-offs, but to find that kind of player is gold for any coach. I mean, like you said, I mean, you can change a game in an instant. You can win a big draw at the end of a game, and it's actually hard to find those kinds of players. A lot of them don't exist. I mean, they train them hard in the U.S. and field lacrosse to be FOGOs and just, take the face off and get off the field kind of thing, and that's it. Where I think, what a skill set. If you can take the face off, stay on, like you did, Jeff, a lot of your career, and stay on and be a threat right away and get a team back in the game. I mean, there's not too many people that have that, kind of skill set where you can do both.
Jim, you're giving me too much credit. I think there's a lot of coaches out there that would say you're wildly incorrect. So I hate that term FOGO. I hate it. I faced off when I got to college, and I always, I always wanted to be, a bigger contributor to the team. And I got to tell you, it was the biggest learning lesson for me. I roomed with Colin, out at the 2006 World Championships, and I was a selfish player, and I think it's part of the component that made me a tough competitor, but it was also a really big lesson for me. I wanted to go in, I wanted to play, I wanted to be on the offense, I wanted to be on the defense, and they asked me to play a specific role, and it was a really tough pill to swallow, but ultimately, like, the biggest lesson that I've maybe ever learned was that it is an important position. I think it's where you see the specialization in the college game. But it also hurts the sport too, if you don't have dynamic players that can play all over the field. And I think, that's where that sort of specialization hurts. The fact that we don't have other guys coming into this league is that, they focus so greatly on just facing off that they forget that they actually have to cast, catch, pass, shoot, think the game, run, play defense. It's hurting that position. So, the rule changes seem to me to be somewhat correlated to leveling the playing field for teams around the league and creating more out of those broken situations.
And I
Jeff,
think
I
that's
have one more
an question. Area of the game that we can agree on is just because, I think there's too many specialists in the game myself, not just in the face-off. I think the game was meant to be played all over the floor as a player. If you want to call yourself a true good lacrosse player, can you play in different aspects of the game? And what you're speaking to, your point there is true for that.
Excellent.
Yeah,
points all around.
You got to be dynamic, and Stamper's cutting us off. You got a time limit on this call, Stamper?
No, go. Hey, keep it.
I should have just picked up the phone and called Jim. We could have rapped about it.
That's right. You just keep going. No, I don't want to cut you off. I want to ask one thing while I remember, and that is, Jeff, how many times in your career did you score a goal when you picked the ball up, had it in your back of your stick, and went down and scored with never flipping it over to the front of the stick?
Oh, never. Not once.
No? Okay.
No, not one time.
Okay, I was curious. I've seen
yeah,
my dad do that.
Yeah, no, I never did that. That's a, it's weird. I was always bringing the ball into the front of my stick. I just never, it's great if you can run down the floor and do that. The problem is that if you get into trouble and you have to make a decision, and granted, there wasn't any trouble that I didn't run myself into. So, but the problem is if you have to get out of trouble and you need to be able to make a play, the game isn't played on the back of the stick. It's played on the front of the stick. I actually really agree with the rule. I like the rule. I think that, I think one step is a little excessive. I think, the circle would be, I know they tested that a year ago or 2 years ago, was coming out of the circle. And the idea was, is they tested it in a game that we were in. And I was like, I'll just stay in the circle and I'll never take it out of the back of my stick. I'll just run around. And it worked, and they never put the rule in. So, I like the idea that you have to remove it from the back of your stick, because I think it devalues the player as well. The game is played on the front of the stick, not the back of the stick. If the if you want to fix the faceoffs, and I said this religiously, is that it's the only position on the floor where you can, where you would play with two hands, you know, this motorcycle grip over top of your stick. Just remove that. You have to play with your hands, you know, one open, one closed, whether you're a lefty or a righty. And you're not allowed to, you know, the where they run into the problems, in even in the college game, is you see these, you know, half an hour face-offs that take forever to get the ball out. Well, it's because the guys are able to brace their stick with their elbow and lie down on sticks because the way their body's positioned. You can't do that if your hand is like a regular grip on your stick. So if you want to fix the face-offs, just don't let anybody motorcycle grip. It'll solve all your problems. And no one wants to do it. So
that's an excellent point. I mean, that would change it dramatically. And it is interesting hearing that from a guy who is, you know, the best face-off guy ever, saying basically make it harder for someone to control a face-off that way, in a sense. But it would, again, force you to have a real skill and not just, I mean, it'd still be a lot of hard work, obviously, when you're battling against another guy for it, but it takes away the just kind of lean and grind, right?
Well, and that's what I like about that idea, is that you can, now you can win face-offs in different ways, not just clamp down on it. Who's the strongest forearms in the league, who just clamps down on it and waits around for, you know, players to be positioned the right place or plunge it up to themselves. I like that idea. Because now, yeah, you have to be much more creative in the ways that you win a face-off.
It's very true, Jim. The only way that you know, when you're a motorcycle gripping face-off guy, you are not raking the ball or, you know, trying to disrupt another player's stick. You're doing one thing and one thing only, and that's clamping on the ball. And it turns into this wrestling match, and it slows the position down. Whereas if you were a regular grip player, you'd have a bunch of different kind of tools in your bag that you'd use, but it would also create a lot more 50-50 ground balls, and it would leave it, you know, the guys who were good at what they did would have to evolve. And then you get, you know, when you get old and you don't get as flexible, it's hard to bend down like that. Like I've seen old photos of myself being like, man, I could tell when it was coming to an end because I couldn't drop my butt low enough to get into a good position. So, you know, that motorcycle gripping, you know, does that. You're able to get nice and low. And that's where this whole, you know, putting your knee down on the turf too. It's, you know, it's all centered around, you know, having a motorcycle position on your stick, and it's slowing down the process, and it's not leveling up the playing field. You know, make players play the proper way with two hands on their stick, the way that you would when you're passing and catching, and I think it solves a lot of problems.
I think it's interesting. I mean, I love talking to both of you guys, because, Jim, I mean, we've had conversations about the Canadian Lacrosse League and the rules you brought in there, and in terms of forcing players to be able to play both ways or be very creative in getting just your offensive guys in the offensive end, defensive guys in the defensive end. It sounds like you both enjoy people playing both, you know, both sides of the game or all sides of the game. And Jim, I'd like to ask you first, whatever you're able to share with us about how you, as a coach with the New England Black Wolves, how you coach the face-off team. What is the approach now with this new rule? How has it changed?
Well, obviously we try to create a loose ball. I mean, we don't have a clamper and somebody who just plunges it up to themselves. So we just try to create a loose ball, and we try to hide, I guess, certain positions we know the ball won't come out. It's usually to an opponent's, I guess it would be their weak side. They usually don't pull it out to that corner. So we try to play balance 2-1-2, and then we rotate our players wherever the ball comes out, just so we have proper defensive coverage.
And Jeff, for you, I mean, you run with your brother Bob, you run Elevate Lacrosse in Calgary, and you know, we were talking earlier about how much of an impact you've had on lacrosse in Alberta, the number of guys coming out of your program and going off to the States to play field lacrosse, moving on into the high levels of box lacrosse. It's just fantastic stuff that's happening. But how do you coach face-offs for all your players that are coming through your programs?
You know, it's so bad and it's terrible. We're actually running our first ever face-off specific camp here in May, and it's something that we've neglected to do because everybody just it lacrosse is young here, and it needs to be brought up to speed, and we didn't want to focus all of our time on one specific position just because, you know, we were good at it. And it's been a disservice to the community, to be honest. We're here, it's something that we're good at, and we should be sharing that, you know, with the kids here. So it's going to change right now. We're going to run specific camps in a program that we call Tech Sessions. So we're going to do, you know, some more specific things with face-off specific players. But again, our message is do not make this the only thing that you do. You know, we want to coach the kids on being great lacrosse players, and if they want to specialize, then they can specialize, but it's not the only thing that we're teaching. You know, we'll do it in the fall. We'll coach a lot of it in the fall just because we need to be competitive when we go down to the States and play face-off specific players. But other than that, we don't do a whole lot of it, which I think has been a negative thing that we're going to be changing. But again, I couldn't agree with Jim more. I took a lot of, I modeled my game and looked up to Jim and how he played and as a young player. And you know, that's how I would have, you know, wanted to. I was a less polite version of Jim, but I tried hard to, I tried hard to, you know, to model, you know, my, you know, that loose ball game, that transition game, that defensive game, you know, and especially aspire to be, you know, a leader and respected the way that he was. So, it's one of those things that you just don't, we're happy that we're going to be doing it now, but it's something that we just haven't focused on, which is going to change.
That's good to hear. I mean,
think,
go ahead, Jim.
Go ahead. So, I just think, you know, you should create a new position. I think you should call it the face off and stay on. So instead of a FOGO, now we have a post.
I tried to, man. I wasn't good enough at one specific thing for it to stick, Jim. They wanted me off the floor. I wish I would have been able to do a little bit more, but I agree with you. I think, guys, if you can have a guy, if you can keep a guy that's weaker on the floor defensively, you do it. And you know, if you had an offensive guy that was a great faceoff guy that you could, you know, keep in the offensive end that was winning faceoffs, I think it put a lot of positive or a lot of pressure on teams and be a positive thing for you know, for your team.
Great example of that, of course, is Jordan McIntosh, who's been a relatively successful face-off guy in the National Lacrosse League. He's been Transition Player of the Year a couple times in the NLL, even though, honestly, he was playing mostly offense when he was named, you know, the winner of that award. But he's so dangerous when he takes face-offs because he can put pressure, like you said, immediately. I mean, Jeff, you were well known for winning face-offs, going down and shooting and scoring right away. McIntosh can do the same thing, but he is a very accomplished offensive player who spent a lot of time in the offensive end, and it really does put pressure on the other team if you have that ability.
Yeah, Jordan's a hell of a player. You know, I think it brings up a point. You know, if you're a Transition Player of the Year, you shouldn't be allowed on a power play. So, you know, he has that dynamic skill set, and if you can add to your game and your toolbox, you know, you're going to have a long, you know, successful career. And I think that's, you know, again, you go back to Jim, you know, picking up ground balls, although, you know, it's, you know, it's mostly what he was known for. I've seen him score a bunch of goals and, you know, make great defensive plays, and he was, you know, he was a nightmare to play against when he played. So I think that, you know, the key is here is to be as dynamic as you possibly can make yourself. Don't just be a goal scorer. Don't just be a defensive player. You know, work on broadening your game.
And Jim has, I mean, he's known for the loose balls.
I would agree with that message, especially for younger players. Just because I think too many of us coaches are starting to pigeonhole players way too early. It's kind of funny because here, you know, in Ontario, they're playing both ends of the floor up until midget, and then all of a sudden midget, you know, coaches are deciding, well, you're an O guy, you're a D guy, kind of get off the floor when you can. And I just think it's a real shame that we do that to kids that have all their life enjoyed both ends of the floor.
One of my favorite examples.
Yeah, I couldn't. Go ahead, Snapper.
I was going to say, Thomas Hogarth, a guy who plays for the Peterborough Junior Lakers, now plays for the Vancouver Stealth, and just
Yeah.
won a Creators Cup with the Durham Turf Dogs. And he's a guy who played both ways, all the way up through Bantam, like everybody else. And a midget was primarily an offensive player. There's like he was very skilled. They had him play offense, and then he went to junior, and they said, "You're a defensive guy." And he's a very good defensive player, one of the best in CLACS last year. He was signed by the Stealth as a defensive player, but I'll tell you, he scored 18 goals this year in the regular season in CLACS. He was one of the most dynamic offensive players in the league, and he has scored a few goals. He scored 2 goals Saturday night. He's got a great twister. He's a very skilled player, and he's a real throwback, and it's great seeing guys like that.
Yeah, I'm go I
Yeah,
agree with you. I've seen
the
Thomas
guy.
play. He's amazing, you know. And I'm even trying to teach my like I got a 17-year-old son who's entering the junior A, junior B ranks now, and you know, and he's saying, "Dad, I really love offense." I say, "You know what? If you want a long career, don't pigeonhole yourself in one position. Like you just show your coaches that you can play both ends and let them decide where they want you to play. But to be honest, don't just say, 'Oh, I'm a forward.'" Because I think you're selling yourself short, and hopefully, you know, abides by that advice. And I think if he does, then I think he has a long career. If he doesn't, then I think now all of a sudden his chances of making a team, whether it be junior A, junior B, or junior C, you know, are limited.
But you look at a guy like Carson Leung. He's a great example of that. Carson, you know,
Yeah.
runs out of the back end for Calgary, runs out of the front end for Victoria. You know, played offense at Bellarmine, and that's. You know, you see a lot of these Canadian defensive players that go down that have great stick skills. I didn't play a shift of defense at the University of Denver. I only played offense. So I couldn't agree with Jim more that, you know, you get into competitive settings in youth sports, you know, coaches want to win. They put the best, you know, they try and put their best lineup out there to go and, you know, and satisfy that, you know, that competitive spirit, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But I do think we're doing a disservice to the kids that are coming up in this sport if they specialize. We go out and run coaching mentorship here and work with the great volunteers here in the Calgary community, and we're telling guys to, you know, let them go run up, run transition, so play defense, go play offense and change, and do that with everybody. And guys want to go OD, and we tell them not to do it because truly you're not doing a you're doing a disservice to the kids that are trying to learn the game.
And a lot of those kids haven't even matured yet. Like a lot of them are just hitting that puberty age and so on, and they're just learning to develop into their bodies and what kind of skill set they have. If you make that decision already when they're 15, 16 years old, who knows? Like they could become a 210-pound kid, and meanwhile they're just playing offense, or you know, or just playing defense right away. Or I just think it's too early.
I couldn't agree with you more.
So, Jeff, when you're coaching kids, I mean, it's one thing, you know, coaching kids in box lacrosse and saying, okay, you're going to play both ends. You're going to go play defense, run up, play offense, come off, or vice versa. But when you're coaching kids in field lacrosse and, you know, there's the lure of the scholarship or the role with the team in the in US college or Canadian college lacrosse here in Ontario, what it's got to be difficult because the coaches are looking for an O guy or a D middie or a long pole. How do you balance the needing to coach them to prepare them for what's going to be wanted of them and also trying to expand their horizons and not pigeonhole them and let them play all facets of the game?
Yeah, we don't tell kids where to play. You know, we'll usually, I think the model for any Canadian long pole is obviously Brodie Merrill. You want a guy that can get out and run the floor. He's big, long, and athletic, and smart, and is a great leader. And you know, you look for those qualities if you're looking to put a kid in that position. And you know, at the same time, you're looking for guys to be offensive threats as well. The one thing I think is that, you know, managing expectations here is a big thing for us. You know, we don't. There are no full scholarships anymore. They don't exist. There's so much demand for Canadian players, and there's so many kids playing the game that, you know, if you can create an environment where you are, you know, paying to go to school what you would to stay at home and pay to go to school, then that's a success. And you're gonna maximize your college experience by being a part of a team. And anything after that is kind of gravy. That's kind of what we shoot for. We don't bring people in and say, "Hey, come get a scholarship." And we say, hey, come in and learn and be a player and be a better player and a leader. And then hopefully at the end of this, we're able to subsidize some of your college expenses with your ability to be a great athlete. With Elevate, we've sent just as many defensive players to school as we have offensive players. And the reality is that Canadian players, are they wanted because they're very talented offensively? I think if you look at any team in the country that's a top 10 team in Division I lacrosse, they have a Canadian presence. Which is a great thing for us. At the same time, going and finding defenders, is challenging, but there's a massive amount of opportunity. There's 380 schools, and there's only, I want to say there's 82 or 83 in Division I. I'm sure my number's off, but, the majority of the schools are in Division II and Division III, and they're all very, very good programs as well. So there's a massive amount of opportunity for kids to go play. Figure out where you want to play, and then pursue that to the best of your ability. I think the key is that as Canadians, we're just becoming better athletes. I think before it wouldn't have, and Jim, this is probably more your era than mine, but I'm sure there was some cigarettes going around the room at halftime or whatever that may be. I think the Canadians are we're no longer the jean shorts, mullet wearing, rum drinking, cigarette smoking athletes that we used to be. I think it's changed a great deal, and guys are making this sport a priority and becoming, you're getting athletically gifted people playing this game, more so than I think it was in the past. It's becoming a primary sport for kids, and it's really exciting to see.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think those stories of those players that were smoking between periods and stuff are totally true. And I was growing up, I couldn't believe that someone could do that. But anyways, I know I couldn't, but I know that there were teammates that could actually play well and be smoking. But nowadays, I mean, you don't even have training camp anymore. These kids are training almost year round or in the off season or getting ready for training camp, and they're in shape before training camp, where we used to use training camp as a way to get into shape. So a lot of that is changing. I would agree with Jeff on that part. And I mean, you just have to look no further than our national program. Like the abilities that we have now as a Canadian national team are way better than when, I played on the 1998 team, and we were lucky to get six long pole people who could actually play long pole. We had offensive guys in Canada that were playing long pole for us, like Tom Fair and Steve Toll played long pole. Meanwhile, those guys are offensive players in the box game. So now it's totally changing, and I really think that we're going in the right direction, and a lot of U.S. Coaches and schools are actually taking a look at Canadians all over the field, not just on attack, a lefty attack, which is what they used to need before.
I think it's interesting. I tend to cover the All Canada Games and things in Oshawa in the summer, which is a pretty big recruiting tournament run by Brody Merrill and his brother Patrick and the guys at the Hill Academy and Edge Lacrosse. And it's been fascinating. I thought last year, possibly the best position in terms of overall talent in that tournament was Longstick Mitty. Running in the footsteps of Brody Merrill. And it was great to see, because it's not just the old guys anymore that are getting the attention. And it is nice to see that balance, because I think a good LSM, Jeff, you talked about what Brody Merrill could do on the field, and it was incredible. And seeing some of these kids, what they can do, the kids who go out there and take face-offs with their long pole, go back and play defense, run the ball up and create a scoring chance. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Brody's done so much for the game. He's not upon being a great guy. He's certainly a great leader, and he's one of the he's a dying breed in terms of a competitor. He's a guy who would win at all costs guy, and he's great. He's a warrior on the floor, and he's an even better guy off the floor. So kids would be crazy not to go and pick up that stick, and I think. You see Americans now, I love it. I love the whole box lacrosse movement in the United States, that it's, they think that if they go out there and they learn how to play box lacrosse, they're going to be a little bit more competitive on the world stage. I don't think they realize that, you go into an arena and a fight breaks out in the stands, and then they turn the lights off and they bring in the RCMP and they pepper spray everybody. That's what we're dealing with, right? Like, we're playing on a very passionate level that I don't think can be replicated other than in this country. And that's what separates us on the world stage, is that, you know, we are just fiercely, fiercely competitive. And it is guys like Brody Merrill and Pat Coyle and Jim Veltman and Tom Fair. And, you know, the list goes on and on and on and on and on. Guys that literally you hate to play against night in and night out that would do anything to win. And that's what separates us as athletes and lacrosse players, is that I think our passion runs a lot deeper than anything that you know, in some sports can't understand. You know, there's stuff that goes on a lacrosse floor that is relatively unspeakable at times, but it's a part of how competitive we are as a breed of athlete. And I think that is what makes, you know, a defenseman or a guy like Brody Merrill such a great guy to have on your team, is that his compete level is second to none.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think that is what separates us, is that passion to win at all costs. I mean, I know the field game in the U.S., they're always so surprised when Canadian teams come down and, you know, and they claim that we're rough and we're this and we're that. But honestly, I just see kids like, I don't think it's a roughness necessarily. It is aggressive play, but it's skill. Like, it's such a skilled aggressive play that I think separates us, where, you know, the U.S. are constantly, well, it's a gentleman's game. And I agree with all that as well, but can you not be, you know, a gentleman and aggressive at the same time? It just seems like in some places in the U.S. there's no place for that. But I would argue that, like as Jeff's saying, is that's what separates us when it comes to especially the world stage.
Excellent points. We are going to wrap up the show there. It's been wonderful having, I think, two of the great gentlemen off the floor and two of the great aggressive athletes in the history of lacrosse on the floor. Jeff Snyder, Jim Veltman, thank you so much for this conversation. I hope everyone enjoys it as much as I did. It was a pretty easy show for me. I got to just pretty much sit back and listen to you guys. It was fantastic.
This was a real treat for me. I really appreciate Jeff coming on, and it's a good show that you do, Stamper. I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Well, thanks so much, Stamper. I, being on the same call with Jim Veltman is truly an honor, and really appreciate the opportunity.
There you go, folks. One of the really great conversations we've had here on Box the Beat on NLL Radio. Also available now on iTunes through Inside Lacrosse Podcasts. So check it out in whichever source is better for you. Thank you for being here. I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did going back to listen to this conversation once again. My voice has had a bit of a rest, and I'm hoping to be back full steam ahead next week with more Box the Beat on NLL Radio.